Welcome to Integrate This, your go-to EdTech podcast where curiosity meets classroom innovation. Join your hosts, David Berner and Jeremy Mikla, as we explore the rapidly evolving world of educational technology. From game-changing tools to insightful conversations with today's top EdTech voices, we're here to help educators stay informed, inspired, and ready to innovate. So tune in, level up, and let's integrate this. Welcome to the Integrate This EdTech podcast. Today, we're very excited to be joined by AI Optimism author, Becky Keene. Very excited to have you with us today. Becky Keene is an educator, author, and speaker focused on innovative teaching and learning. She specializes in instructional coaching, game-based learning, and integrating AI into education to empower students as creators. She has developed esports programs for schools and explores immersive learning through games. Becky speaks globally on AI in education and has spent over 20 years designing professional learning experiences for teachers. A national board certified teacher, ISTE certified educator, and certified instructional coach, she has spent 15 years teaching, coaching, and leading programs in public schools. She is the author of the book, AI Optimism, and holds a master's in ed in early literacy. So welcome, Becky. Very happy to have you here joining the Integrate This podcast. Can you give the audience a little bit more insight into your background and how the last 20 years here have gone for you? And now you've got the book release as well. So
yeah, thanks. First of all, thanks for having me and happy to share a little background. Sometimes people ask about my career journey. I've spent this is my 25th year in supporting public education, which is nuts to me that it's been that long. But I taught elementary school and then I taught middle school. And I was really fortunate to work with people, leaders, school leaders, system leaders who allowed me to do things I was excited about, who didn't kind of keep me in a box or force me to follow some curriculum. A lot of the mantra early on in the 2000s was, if your test scores are good enough, you can do whatever you want. And so that was really helpful for me. And I got to do a lot of really innovative and creative things, which really set the stage for me understanding that there's a lot possible in education if we move some of those challenges out of the way. And so that was really fun. And I got to be a part of a lot of different proof of concept programs and pilot programs because I said yes. I just kept saying, sure, I'll do that with my students. Yeah, I'd love to try that out. And then I was invited at some point to work at a system level in my school district south of Seattle, Washington, to help support ed technology district-wide and really scale the programs that I had been piloting in my own classroom with some other teachers as well. And so we worked on that for about 10 years. And then I had the opportunity to join my current company, I2E, and help schools and systems, primarily North America, but we work with companies and organizations worldwide to help them implement technology in new and innovative ways. In the business world, we focus on productivity and creativity. And then in the education space, obviously, we focus on best teaching and innovation, which is a ton of fun. So that's a little bit about me. And somewhere along the way, I became a LinkedIn learning instructor, which is fun. And I have two books now and a blog and a newsletter, and I do all sorts of, and TikTok vlogs. I do all sorts of little things, but it's been really fun to get out there and get connected with educators like you from all over.
Yeah. And that's really awesome. I've seen a couple of your TikTok walks that you've done here in the last couple of weeks or so. But it was really cool for me to be able to connect with you at ISTE this year. Yeah. I know I came up, you were doing a tabletop presentation, and I came by there, and it was nice to be able to connect with you there. But overall, what would you say about an experience like a conference like that, you know, being able to not just kind of get your message out there about your book, but to be able to like find networks of people who kind of like are on the same wavelength and can kind of like get to understand kind of what it is that, you know, helps make ed technology kind of supportive of increasing student learning. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And I love ISTE. It was kind of a dream of mine to go when I was working for my school system. And I finally got up the guts to ask. And my supervisor said, "Of course you can go. Why didn't you ask before?" And my teammate and I were like, "Oh, I guess we should have asked earlier. I don't know why we thought it was beyond us." So I've been attending ISTE for over 10 years straight, and it's an amazing event. I love the energy. I love, you know, connecting with people. It's obviously the one-stop place to be in June for ed tech. However, I will say that in the past 5 years, I've spent a lot of time in smaller regional ed tech conferences. In my role at I2E and also as a featured speaker, I get to go out and attend some of these other events. And I just want to add that as a word of encouragement for all of the listeners, that going to a smaller regional event, I think, is often more impactful because you have more time to really connect with people and network, and there are fewer sessions to choose from, which actually makes life a little bit easier. I mean, ISTE is nuts as far as, like, at any given moment, there are 15 things you could be doing. And that's exciting, but I do find high value in the regional tech conferences, both in connection and time, and just the availability to really dig deeper with individuals and with the vendors who are there. It's just not quite so chaotic. So there's a place for both.
But it's really, it's really funny that you bring that up, because last week, David and I both hosted regional tech conferences in our different parts of Minnesota, where it was just exactly like you're describing it. Fewer sessions, but it's much easier for presenters because they're dealing with other teachers and educators that are, like, from their area and from their schools and deal with similar issues. But at the same time, it's also, like you said, the number of choices is just, it's more manageable and it's easier to find a track that you could go down. You know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah. So I really enjoy those. My regional is, called NCCE here in the Seattle area. And I've been attending that since 2004, I think. And I've presented there most of those years. And it's just a great event. It's not huge, but you get a lot done. So.
Yeah. And I know what you're saying about ISTE. I think I've literally had FOMO for another session while sitting in a really good session at ISTE. Yeah. So that tends to happen. But and Jeremy and I, like you said, we do a number of trainings too. And one of the things that I saw you posted recently that you start some of your trainings with that I found really interesting was the AI personalities concept that you posted. I had seen that on LinkedIn, and I thought it was a really great, like, a bell ringer, I guess, if you want to call it, like, for those that are attending the training to identify, are you, like, one of these personalities? There's five on there. It's like, are you one of these personalities, or, are you a combination of them? And it did a nice job of laying out the different feelings that people have around AI. Why do you think that was, like, an important exercise to include in your trainings recently?
I think it's really important that we validate the emotions attached to generative AI. And as an AI optimist, I don't want to focus on fear or negativity. Honestly, there's a lot of negative around generative AI, and I want to recognize the challenges and the issues around privacy and safety and bias and the things that are true and real. But I also don't want to dwell there. And so I've found that giving people an avenue to kind of claim their excitement and their concerns in a way that was, the word I guess is inclusive, right? Like, hey, we all have opinions about this and they all add value to the conversation. And it's okay to say, like, hey, I really care about the human element. There's a flip side to all of those AI personalities where we're concerned, but I think it frames it in a positive light. We're like, this is what you're bringing to this conversation. Last week I was working with a school in Southern California, and one of the teachers just kind of had a moment during one of our breakout sessions. And he was kind of upset. I mean, I could feel his frustration around some of his expectations around AI and how those weren't met and how students are misusing it at times. And I just stopped the conversation and said, thank you for sharing. I think other people in the room have similar concerns, and it's really important we talk about these things. I said, you sound like a traditionalist, and there's room for you. That, you know, you don't have to feel like you're not a part of this conversation. And he came up to me after the session and thanked me for how I handled it, because he didn't feel like he was an outsider. He was a part of the community that we were, you know, learning together. So I just think the personalities lend themselves to that type of culture in the school system. And of course, whenever people feel included and validated, that's a good day.
Right. And to be honored is just going to, you know, to know that their opinion matters and that you're honoring their position and where they're at currently is just going to make it easier, I think, for them in the long run to start to maybe come over to that optimist side gradually. Right. But, you know, like, since you brought up the you being an AI optimist here, and why don't you spend a minute here and tell us, you know, what was kind of the inspiration behind the writing of AI Optimism?
Well, I have to tell you that the title came last, and really? A lot of people are surprised at that. Yeah, I didn't like have this vision to write about AI optimism and then write a book. I wrote the book, and based on what I felt was missing, honestly, kind of this hole in the space of education AI, where we have some people doing a great job surfacing concerns, and we have some people doing a great job talking about, you know, tools and what those look like in education. And I felt there was this gap of not understanding kind of the trajectory of AI, if you will. And that's why I use the SAMR model in the book, because I saw so many educators scrambling to, quote, use AI. And that's the wrong approach. And that has always been the wrong approach to me as an instructional coach. We shouldn't be focused on what tool am I using or how much am I using technology. It's really about meeting student needs and developing learning experiences that transform and empower learning. And so I felt like people were just, you know, getting kind of distracted by the sparkly glitter of AI and all these little apps popping up. And I was seeing social media posts like, I want to use AI with my students. Where should I start? And those are heartbreaking to me, because it's the wrong lens. It's tool centric, it's use centric, you know, instead of thinking about what I want to achieve with my students. And so as I started having that roll around in my head, I felt like the SAMR model was a really good tool to help people understand maybe where they had started with using AI and then what was possible to really redefine. And then after I started looking at all these different use cases, I started thinking about how they fit into these categories. And that's where the AI optimism framework started. So this whole thing kind of was designed in a backwards way, right? Like backwards design. We'll just give them a shout out right now. Because I had the ideas, and then I thought, okay, these fit into six categories of how we use, like, the things we have to do in education every day. We have to design and create and support and analyze and evaluate and manage. And those are the things we're doing. And so how can I help educators categorize and say, okay, if I want to evaluate student use and student growth in my classroom, what are some tools I can use? And how much do I want AI to be involved? Is it just at a substitution level? Or am I, you know, going to really modify what I've been doing or redefine something completely unique and different? And so And then I had to write the beginning of the book, which is like, okay, if you're going to do all those things, I need you to understand first what I believe about privacy and praxis and prompting. And so really the whole thing came about backwards. And the very last thing was the title, which was a conversation I had with my editor when he said, okay, but you really need a title because we need to work on a cover. And we have, like, the book was already through developmental and kind of far along the process when I finally landed on what I wanted to call it. And that's simply because the middle of the book to me was what I wanted to say. And then it took me a while to figure out how to put that into one succinct two or three words.
And the SAMR model has been around for a while. And, you know, that was developed
a long while.
That was developed by Dr. Ruben Puntadora, who did the forward for the book as well. Right.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Or I got two questions, I guess. What was it like talking with him about this process, or, you know, what conversations did you have with him, being that you were going to use the SAMR model? And ultimately, why did you feel like that would be the most complementary model to what you were trying to convey in the book?
Well, I actually started field testing SAMR within AI over a year before the book published, because I'd had it kind of rumbling around in my head. So some of the things I did is I started presenting with the SAMR model infused in my AI workshops. So we just talked about NCCE, for example, February 2024. So a year and a half ago now, I did a couple of workshops for NCCE as just a presenter at the conference, and I infused SAMR into the AI workshop I was leading, and rave reviews. Like, people were coming up to me saying, this makes so much sense. I'm so thankful. It makes so much sense now to, you know, think about my purpose first and then go back and look at how I'm using the tools, and just got amazing feedback. I did the same thing at IdeaCon last year. I was there as a featured speaker, and I just put it in. And the feedback I was getting was that it was really helpful. Educators were like, this is beautiful. And then Matt Miller's team at Ditch That Textbook invited me to write a guest blog. And I said, hey, I'd like to do SAMR AI. Like, let's see how that lands, and put that out really broadly because he has massive reach. And so I did that guest blog, and that went out, and he had people later come up to him and say, this could be a book. Like, Becky's blog makes so much sense. Have you thought about doing a book? And Matt and I had a little side conversation, and he was like, I think you're going to get something for that. Because he was kind of in the loop on the whole book idea earlier. And so I got really good feedback from educators that was the right path to be going down. You know, there's a lot of different models we can use that all add value. But I think for what I wanted to communicate, it really was a perfect fit.
Yeah, and I think the SAMR model is great just in terms of like the depth in which you are integrating technology, and has been for a long time. But what I really like is how you've applied AI to that, and particularly because it's new and a lot of people are kind of like, how do we use this and to what degree? And, you know, with our students, what does that look like? So.
And I'm sorry, you had a two-part question, and I can't let the conversation move on without giving credit to Dr. Puntadora. He was so great. So I had a mutual colleague connect us, and he didn't reply right away, and that's totally okay. Like, I don't reply instantly to everything that hits my inbox either. Sometimes we're drowning. So I gave it a little time, and then I sent him another little ping and said, hey, you know, just checking in, is this something you'd be interested in? And he got right back to me. He was like, yes, I thank you for the second email, which is a great reminder that, like, it's okay to send a second email sometimes. He's like, thank you so much for getting in touch. Yes, I would love to be a part of this. You know, let me know what you need. And so I just, knowing that life is busy for everyone, and I'm sure he has a lot on his plate, I didn't really want to hold my breath on, like, it would have been okay with me if it came to the time he was ready to write a forward and he was swamped with something else in life. Like, that would have been okay. My publisher was super excited. They're like, this is amazing. He agreed to write it. And then he did. Like, we just were in communication from then on. As far as the timing, you know, I would give him updates on, okay, I think I'm going to have a really solid manuscript to you by this time, and so on. And he was so sweet. He wrote me back after he read it the first time and was like, he said, I have 7 pages of notes. So can I have a little extra time to write the forward? Like, he was so complimentary and positive about how I reflected his work in an AI sense. And that was just really exciting for me as well, to have him be a part of the project and lend his voice to something that I think really makes sense.
And definitely it does. And I'll admit here that I didn't really, when I first started even presenting on AI, really consider the SAMR model as something that should be integrated through the training of teachers and the different levels and where they're at and how it can even change depending on the type of activity and stuff you have. But I remember presenting on the SAMR model when I was still in the classroom and doing some of the part-time technology integration stuff, you know, when we were first going one-to-one and trying to get students and teachers to use their devices more purposefully and not just as that substitution tool to, hey, don't just write your notes on your notebook paper anymore. Let's, you know, type them on our iPad or, you know, like some of those things. So I think one of the things that I really appreciated too from the book is how you make that ease of entry into AI use through the SAMR model, I think much more accessible to teachers. But I'm also kind of wondering, do you think there's like, what sort of barriers do you think teachers face when it comes to adopting AI into their practice, even at like some of those basic substitution levels?
Oh, so many, so many challenges. I think if I could categorize them into one topic, it would be lack of trust. And that has several different pieces to it. One is not trusting the tool to keep their data safe or their students safe. Another one is not trusting that it's not going to be used to, you know, train the model or use their data without their permission long term. So short term and long term. Then there's the lack of trust that it will return great results that are accurate and reliable. I hear a lot from educators how they've tried using a tool, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't pick an LLM, and they've been disappointed with the results. And so they've chosen to walk away from all of AI because of that experience. And we know that in education specifically, having been a trainer in education for 20 years, if educators don't see valid, reliable, trustworthy, responsible use on the first use, they're not coming back to that tool. Like, that's pretty universal. And so it's been really difficult because generative AI is still new in the realm of the universe, right? We're 2.5-3 years in. And the tools are changing at lightning speed. And so when you've seen something work or not work last week, it might be completely different this week. And I've been talking to educators about I'm just calling it AI grit, and reminding them that 25 years ago, they had to learn how to search Google, right? We had to learn how to type in queries, and like all the hits were wrong, and it didn't work the first few times. And we've been teaching students that ever since in digital literacy lessons. And for some reason, I think we've gotten really comfortable with Alexa and Siri and the tools that we've had for a long time. And so this tool, when it didn't respond the way we expected it to throw it out feels a little bit easy, you know, like easy quitter. Mm-hmm. And we don't, you know, not everyone has time to learn and learn prompting. And I've heard that argument, but I've also just kind of come back and said, hey, you spend the time to learn what's important to you. When you got an air fryer, you know, you got out all these recipes and you figured out how to use it and you made sure your Trader Joe's orange chicken turned out amazing. Like, you put the time in. So if you want to use these tools, like, you're going to have to put some time in. And that's why my third core principle is prompting, because the reality is it doesn't always do what we think it's going to do. And throwing it out because it didn't return the experience we hope is the wrong approach.
Yeah, and it's definitely in the classroom teaching kids how to do Google searches. I'm that old too.
Same.
I remember even like, when I would first kind of talk to teachers to try to remind them or to maybe build their trust or to tell them that they feel supported, that if we want to go way back, you know, and talk about even like when I was in school, the librarian in the school library, because we didn't even call them media centers then, was showing us how to use the card catalog and how we would find journal and periodical articles in the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature. And those have their own strategies that you need to employ to get the best results possible for the information that you're looking for. And I really do feel like with prompting and to get the best results that you're looking for, there are skill sets there that you need to learn also. And so I'm right with you with what you're talking about when it comes to that. So appreciate that.
Yeah. And I like the AI grit term too, because like, I feel like as much as I've used AI and these different programs, like I feel like failure is almost essential to the whole process, because mm-hmm. it's like, I can't, you know, every single time I go to it, I basically think like, it's going to take several iterations of me talking to this and explaining what it is I want to actually get what I have in my mind, you know, what it is that I want. But.
And just to expand on that briefly, different AI tools respond different ways. And I've heard lots of people say, you know, you can think of them as different friends. We don't want to overhumanize AI, but it is a nice lens to be thinking about. You know, I have one friend I might ask for advice on making a meal for my family because she cooks really well. I might have another friend that I ask for advice on a fitness plan, or another friend that I'm like, hey, what's a good vacation spot? So, you know, looking at not just using one, a lot of us are, we have this core desire to find like the one ring to rule them all. And we think this one tool is going to do everything. And with generative AI, I don't see it. I see different tools fitting different needs. And that takes time to learn as well. So it can feel so overwhelming for educators who are already tapped out in, you know, the amount of things they're supposed to do and manage and learn. So that was another hope of my book, is that they could use it as a guidebook and just flip right to a strategy they were interested in, see a couple of tool recommendations or prompt recommendations, and go from there. Instead of having to feel like they're starting with this empty slate, at least they're getting something to start with.
Yeah. And it's been interesting too. Like we've had a lot of conversations with our special education department on the various things that they can do, you know, to save time and work with students on. And one of the things that you bring up in the book is personalized learning. And so you look at that as one of the boons of AI, right? The personalized learning, how can that, be something that can really be utilized by any teacher, in your opinion?
Well, I think that term is getting overused a little bit at the moment. Like everybody's like, and then AI can personalize learning. And without an actual application of what that looks like, I think it can be really difficult to understand what that even means. I've seen it work a variety of different ways. So even at a substitution level, I just talked about this with some math teachers last week. I said, hey, give like a ChatGPT or a Copilot or whatever your kids have, or a Gemini, give it what you're trying to learn in math and then their interests. And it created these story problems that were maybe more relevant for the students. Now, that's just a strict substitution level. And one of the teachers said to me, I already have a book full of story problems. Like, why would I do this? And I said, hey, I think you missed my point. And that's good feedback for me as the presenter. Like, I think you maybe missed something. And I said, the whole point here is that students, which is what I said, and he like missed it, but is that students would be writing the story problems based on them being interviewed by the AI and coming up with story problems that they're actually interested in. And we were talking about graphing literary inequalities. With graphing linear inequality, two of them specifically, now there's a decision point. And so they were actually writing story problems that caused them to question their own value system and think about what they would choose based on a scenario. Like there was so much more here than a story problem. And it was something that resonated with those individual students. So in my like sample lesson, the students were then telling a story around, okay, if I have two choices in how to spend my afternoon, either doing homework or a hobby with friends, but I only have a finite amount of time and I have to get my homework done, like, where is that intersection? That's two linear inequalities. So I'm like, isn't that more interesting for your students to like talk through and think about when it actually connects to their own life than a story problem out of a book? And so with all that in mind, I think personalized learning has this huge range, right? It can be as simple as just literally personalizing the content that you're trying to generate, but it can be as powerful as a full personalized learning pathway where students are being taken along a journey of growth from their own starting point through meeting standard at a certain level. And there's specialized apps that do that, that are really good. That's what they're designed for. So personalized learning has kind of gotten this, I think, overkill at the moment. But the reality is that there are a wide variety of tools and options that fit in that umbrella modality.
And AI can definitely, I think, or generative AI, assist you in finding ways to, or to help a teacher connect the content to the interests of their students. In fact, we just had an interview the other day with instructional technology specialist from out east in Massachusetts. Her name is Liz Vosey, and she has a project that she works with elementary age teachers in her buildings that she helps to support, called the Perfect Book Project. And really it is using, it is a reading lesson, a reading project, and not a writing or an AI project, right? But it's to have students work with AI to help create books and stories with plots and characters and subjects that they're interested in. And then they help to design outlines for these chapters of the book. The students work to add their own ideas in with ones suggested by AI. And in the end, they produce a manuscript, right, that they turn around and they go to like Staples and they have it published. So they get a physical copy of the book as well. And then they keep copies of those books in their own libraries, right? So now you're building a library of all of these different things that kids have personalized, right? And made their own, and they're using those to help themselves become better readers, which is just amazing in my mind, how you're able to take some of those concepts and put that all together. And that same thing could apply like in the math situation, like you're talking about.
Yeah. That's what a wonderful project.
So Becky, one of the things that you brought up was prompting. And I know when I do trainings and stuff, I have a prompting strategy that I like to encourage people to follow. And I know there's several, acronyms, because we're teachers and educators. We have an acronym for everything. But I'm kind of curious, is there a frame that you kind of think of when you are talking with educators about how to become better prompters? Or is it maybe even like, I'll give you maybe even part of my answer to this too. I'm starting to become a little more of a convert to the conversational method of just having that dialogue develop too, but I don't know if that's the best either. But is there kind of a format that you tend to follow?
There is. I do a whole session called The Art of Prompting sometimes when invited. And we dig into just a myriad of ways you can prompt powerfully. In the book, I use Saba Kinway's model Spark, because she's just a wonderful advocate for using AI. And she kindly, said, yes, I could include that in the book as one of the models. And I wanted to promote her as a woman in AI. But I do a lot of Copilot training in my day job. And there is a model that Microsoft uses that's just goal, context, expectations, and oh my gosh, why am I blanking on the fourth thing? This is weird. I do it all the time. Source. There we go. Thank you. Goal, source, expectations, and context. And so that kind of just is the simplest to me. And it doesn't require anything like fancy or interesting. It's not an acronym. Which is probably why I blanked on source, but it really makes sense to me. Like most of us prompt AI with a goal initially, but adding context and expectations is something that we often don't. And AI will over-deliver at a frustration level because it doesn't know what you want, right? If you're prompting vaguely, it's like just throwing things back at you. And so I do tend to just kind of stop and I close my eyes a lot of times, honestly. And I think, okay, if I was telling a human this direction, like someone who worked for me, let's pretend I have a real assistant, a human assistant, like what would I say? And often I find it's a whole lot more details than I was going to tell AI. And that feels backwards. Like, why would I tell AI less? They don't know less, right? And so I feel like I have to at some point remember that AI is not, it doesn't know everything I think it's going to know. It can't read my mind. I have to give it more details than I think. And when I do that, I get much better results. And so one tip I'll give that I really appreciate as well, that my colleague Nathan Wells says a lot, is that he'll at the end of his prompt say, and is there, ask me any questions you need, you know, to know about this before you answer me, or is there anything I should have added to this prompt? Like, and the AI will tell you. Claude is actually my favorite model for that method, because I think it does a great job of asking questions and prompting the user on what else it needs to do a good job answering your question. It will do that even without you prompting it. It'll just be like, actually, before I answer you, can you help me with these questions? And I love that, because it does feel more like a thought partner that way. So I think the biggest advice I can give on prompting is to offer more, not less.
And, you know, I think along those lines, I think teachers kind of naturally are good explainers and providing background and context to things, because we do that every day when we introduce an assignment or an activity or a lesson. We kind of have to fit it within the frame of connecting it to the student's prior knowledge and let them know what we're doing so that we know where we're going. And I find keeping that in my head, too, as I'm starting to prompt, really helps get better results. But I really am going to take your suggestion of asking the question, you know, what else am I missing that should be included? Because I often overlook that.
And because it's a thought partner and highly creative, AI will come up with things that we wouldn't have, you know? And so when I'm designing new workshops or new strategies, I'll sometimes take, and I'm not exaggerating here, an hour of dialoguing with AI. Like, I'm thinking, it's asking me questions, and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, well, how would I approach that? What do I believe about that? And we're having this conversation back and forth. And at the end of that hour, I have really refined my ideas. It's incredibly helpful.
Have you had any conversations with teachers about, like, you know, I think with our roles, I know that Jeremy and I particularly spend, like, compared to teachers, right, we spend a bunch of time in front of our computer with these systems. So like ChatGPT, or maybe if it's like Magic School, and, you know, we have time to kind of really dig in and do tutorials on them and things like that. Have you had any conversations with teachers that kind of streamline their process a little bit? Because as we know, like, when they're getting back into, like, back to school week, it's crazy. They've got all sorts of trainings that are required of them. And so to sink as much time as we do into AI, it's really impossible for them. Have you had any good conversations with teachers about, like, how do they start planning and organizing for their classes and, you know, provided the time constraints that they have?
Yeah. The one advice that I often give when they say, like, I just don't feel like I have time to learn it, as I say, don't worry about learning it, like, as a goal. Like, we would say the same thing about Minecraft or Canva. Like, I'm not just going to sit down and do a bunch of tutorials. I always say, find a purpose. Like, when you have a problem to solve is my big recommendation. So let's say that, you know, I had this conversation with educators just late last week where I said, okay, so, like, what's something that you wish was different about your classroom, or, like, you're trying to come up with a poster or a better way to explain something? Like, what's a problem that you want solved? And then can you ask AI for help with that? And I tell them, be very specific, like, give lots of details on what you want. You know, do that good prompting, but they don't have to, like, memorize some prompt framework to just give it lots of, you know, lots of description. And so giving those use cases as far as having a problem to solve, I think, is really helpful. When I see teachers get frustrated, it's when they feel like they're supposed to just go use it and they don't even know what for. You know, they're like, okay, well, I don't need it to write an email for me. Like, I'm good. Thanks. I can answer my email. So what am I using it for? And focusing on that, what is a problem you want help solving, is really helpful.
Yeah. Now, let's kind of get into the book here a little bit, because I feel we've had great conversations, but I also want to bring up some of the great points in the content that's in the book. You know, of course, you've mentioned how and discussed how it's based on the SAMR model, or you apply that model to generative AI use within education. But, you know, what are some of your kind of things that stick out in your mind about, you know, pick an activity if you wish, or a topic, and maybe kind of give us an idea of how a teacher might approach it from the different levels within that SAMR model?
Oh, goodness.
Is that too vague? I can be more specific if you want.
Yeah, that's super. There's like 100 strategies in the book.
A teacher would like, you know, a special ed teacher is, you know, needing some assistance, maybe scaffolding, you know, some directions within their lessons and stuff like that. Like, how could they do that using AI on some of those different levels?
Well, okay, that's a little narrower. So what's interesting about what you just said is that we start at the substitution level without even using generative AI. And this is a good time to call that out, is that AI is this big umbrella, and I'm optimistic about all of it. Generative AI is a subset of artificial intelligence that we've been laser focused on for a long time now because of all the controversy and all the possibilities. So for a special education teacher that's looking to scaffold or support would be the category of the AI optimism framework. We start with just substitution. Like, can we be giving audio directions? Can we be giving graphic directions? Do we need to allow for translated directions for an assignment or for a task? And all of that is done with what we would call more traditional AI resources, right? Dictation, translation, read aloud. That's all just kind of normal AI that's been around for a really long time. But then we could get into visualizing those directions. We now have tools like Notebook LM and Copilot Notebooks that will generate in Word Online. Now we'll generate that audio overview, kind of podcast style, of a set of directions or content information. Google LM, just Notebook LM for Google, just announced video as a possibility. And so giving kids that multimodal input, if we're looking to just kind of raise some understanding. Going to a more transformative level is where we can have students actually engaging. So speaking of personalized learning, scaffolding the directions to an assignment in a way where they also are asking questions, and not just absorbing information. And I think that's a big shift for me in the framework, as far as the S and A levels of SAMR being very focused on pushing kids content, right? Giving them things, where the M and R levels are more about kids being engaged and a part of the generative AI, a part of the content. So maybe we have students copy and paste the directions for a task into napkin.ai, and that creates a whole little infographic for them on the steps involved that's very visual. And because they initiated that, they weren't just handed a graphic, they're then able to go in and interact and even evaluate that graphic and be like, is this correct? Like, are these actually the steps? And then they can add to that graphic. They could add in, okay, this is what I'm going to do at this step in the process, which takes us into supporting executive function and self-regulation and all these great skills. At another level, we could be setting up like a school AI sidekick space that gives students an opportunity to ask the chatbot questions. And that's a really safe place for many kids. I know the word safe can be weird, but the reality is it's low risk, maybe is a better term. It's low risk to ask a chatbot questions about how to complete an assignment. Way lower risk than asking a teacher, and for sure lower risk than asking a classmate and feeling like you're stupid, which is a whole nother set of SEL we could talk about. So giving kids access to those tools as supports that they get to then choose when they access and when they use them based on their own needs is incredibly exciting. And it gives them that AI literacy of making a decision of when to use AI appropriately. So we're doing way more than just scaffolding an assignment now. We're also empowering them to say, when does AI limit my learning and when does it amplify my thinking? And that's, I think, where things get really exciting.
And could we dive into that a little bit too? Like, there's a ton of stuff with regard to students where or a lot of conversations happening around there are massive benefits and to it. There's also some concerns about the cognitive offloading side where mm-hmm. you know, we're kind of like we're having the machines basically perform the task. And there's conversations around like, what are the best ways to go about using these? And I always say too, like in our trainings, it's not just students, like it's us as professionals too. There's that danger of offloading your own thinking into these so that you're not really going through the creative process or the struggle and things like that. Have you had conversations around that piece of cognitive offloading that is a danger? And then also with that, do you have any concerns about like the social aspect too? A lot of articles lately have been saying things about, you know, students having relationships with chatbots and, mm-hmm. you know, the fear of that replacing the social aspect or like emotional growth. So basically the kind of the two things I'm wondering your thoughts on are, the dangers of the intelligence piece, the cognitive offloading, and then the emotional piece of, I guess you could say social offloading. Like you're not engaging with real humans, you know, face to face or even like in this version where we're talking virtually, obviously. Do you have any concerns there with those two things?
100%. And I have lots of TikTok walks where I talk about outsourcing and outsourcing humanity and outsourcing our creativity. Like those are things that are kind of scary. Now, I will say the MIT study with ChatGPT, I feel like that was headlined to be clickbait. It was a really unfortunate framing of that entire study, in my opinion, because they didn't study people who used AI appropriately. Like the study shows, kids generated essays with AI and then copied and pasted it into a document and hit submit and didn't know what they said. Like, oh yeah, okay. Like who is funding these studies? Sometimes I want to be like, I would like a study with a no-brainer ending. So yeah, obviously that didn't require any cognitive lift. That's not how we should be using AI. So it's really interesting as we think about my essential question, does this use of AI limit my learning? That I think does help students evaluate, okay, what am I supposed to actually be doing here? And this gets us into like a whole trajectory rabbit trail conversation on what are we actually assessing? Because I'll give you a really simplistic example. But when my son was a first grader, he came home and told me about a timed math assessment where he had to write numbers into a grid, right? Like 100 grid. And then there was a backside and he was telling me how he didn't get to finish because the timer went off. But he told me, he's like, but if I would have finished, I would have gotten to 245. And I was like, well, how do you know that? You didn't finish. And he goes, oh, because the timer went off. We had to put our pencils down, but then I just counted the rows remaining and I know I would have gotten to 245. So as a first grader, like he knew the math and he goes, but I didn't get to show that I knew that because the time ran out. And I said, oh, so it wasn't assessing your ability to count. It was assessing your ability to write quickly. Like that's what she's scoring. She's scoring your ability to write quickly. And not to be critical of his first grade teacher, who was wonderful. But I think a lot of times in education, we forget what we're actually assessing. And sometimes we give these assignments and we want to assess like the student writing. And we forget that we're also assessing along the way a lot of other things that we maybe don't need to be. Like maybe we're assessing student creativity, or we're assessing their spelling, or we're assessing their ability to stay on task for significant periods of time, or we're assessing their ability to take a very large project and break it into chunks and then self-manage all the normal steps that go into a project. Like that's what we're actually assessing. And so removing some of those barriers for kids does allow us to get to what we actually want to assess, which is, can they produce high quality work in many cases? And if we don't want them to have any supports to produce high quality work, then that is now part of the assessment. Is, can you do this 100% independently, or did you get help? And who did you get help from, or what did you get help from? Because we've had these support mechanisms in place for a long time. The difference with generative AI that I hear about a lot is that it overhelps, right? It goes beyond the line that a human would, or a tutor, or someone at home, or some other tools that we've had in the past. And so I believe we have to allow students to help to understand that line, because I don't think we're helping them for their future if all we do is tell them, like, no, you're not allowed to use AI on this. Or yes, you are. And we don't help them see why. Like, why? What am I assessing and what am I trying to do? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure all the listeners aren't going to see me keep nodding my head to the screen. But I, like, through all of that part that you just talked about, that's exactly what I was doing. I know we're coming up here to the end of our time that we have for today. But so can we just kind of go back to, you know, obviously, I know that the title didn't come till the end, but still, right. You know, why should educators be AI optimistic?
Because most educators, I'm just going to be a blanket statement here, most educators went into education because they believe they could make a difference. And they love that feeling of, like, imparting knowledge or helping others, helping students. If we look at personality assessments of educators, because we're big on that as a company at I2E. And anyway, they're, like, hands down relators. They're connectors. They're people who want to invest in other humans. And so I think our only option is to be excited about the possibilities of where we can let this go to support our learners. Like, ultimately, AI optimism is about acknowledging the challenges, but focusing on the potential. And that's an important caveat, where we're going to nod our heads like you were, like, yes, there are some issues here, but I'm going to choose to look at what's possible for the betterment of my students and what this means to support them in a world that will inevitably require them to use AI. And that's what AI optimism is all about.
Great. Well, we really appreciate you joining us for the podcast, and we would really encourage everybody to remain AI optimistic. Please go get the book from Amazon or wherever you can find the book, and it's a good read. You'll learn a lot of great things from it. And check our show notes. We'll have links to the book in the show notes. Becky, is there? How can people get a hold of you if they'd like to? The socials, are there any upcoming events and things that you want to plug to let folks know?
Well, a great way to get in touch with me is my website, BeckyKeen.com. I'm the only Becky Keen, like, not in the world, but if you just, like, Google Becky Keen, I will come up, or ask ChatGPT, how do I get in touch with Becky? I will come up. So that's easy. And that links to all my social sites. People can follow me there. It's also links to both books, and there's book resources as well, like a book study guide for people who are looking to do it as a book club group. I do virtual author talks for those groups. So lots of resources there, BeckyKeen.com. And then coming up, let's see. I mean, I don't know when this is going out, but I there's a couple of conferences that I'll be at as featured speaker in the coming school year, and I'm not able to announce that quite yet, because I need to wait for them to announce me first. But I'll be around, especially during conference season. So that's exciting.
Okay. Well, so if we can, we'll
keep,
for
keep
sure.
Keep an eye on my socials.
Yeah. Yeah. Check the socials. We'll for sure. If we can, we'll put them in the show notes if we're allowed to, but.
Perfect. Yeah.
If once not after the fact, out,
I can share more. Yeah. But it'll be fun to see educators around the US in the coming year.
Good. Well, thanks again. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah. I appreciate it. All right. Bye guys. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Integrate This. Want to take your learning further? Head over to our YouTube channel for quick tutorials, deep dives, and more EdTech tips you can use right away. Don't forget to subscribe and catch new podcast episodes every Thursday on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, keep exploring, keep innovating, and keep integrating this.